Hello, and welcome to the RCGP podcast on type 2 diabetes, a cardiorenal metabolic syndrome. My name is Sam Robinson. I'm a GP and an e-learning fellow for the RCGP. And today I will be talking to Dr. Sarah Jarvis, MBE. Sarah is a GP with a special interest in diabetes and is a visiting professor of general practice at Huddersfield University. She is frequently the voice of general practice in the media and has various residencies in TV and radio. She is currently the clinical director of the health information website patient.info and is a prolific author. Hi, Sarah, and thank you for your time today.
Lovely to be with you.
Wonderful. Today, we're going to talk about type 2 diabetes, which is obviously a huge subject. So let's try and focus on the areas most relevant to primary care. These days, we see diabetes less as an isolated condition and more as part of a group of conditions. And I wondered if you could give us a brief explanation about how type 2 diabetes interconnects with cardiac and renal pathophysiology.
Absolutely. So this is a really important point and one which is very close to my heart. I have been a GP long enough to have had patients who were told when they were given a diagnosis of what was then called maturity onset diabetes. And most of you listening will never have heard of that. That's what we used to call type 2 diabetes. They were told sometimes that they had a touch of sugar or the mild kind of diabetes. And things haven't been, I know I can see you laughing, Sam, but really things have changed an awful lot. But it literally, when I became a GP, that's the way we thought of it, because the onset was not as dramatic. And of course, the incidence was so much lower, we didn't know nearly as much about it. Now, of course, we do know that it is very much a serious condition and one that needs to be taken very seriously. So we have known, I think, for a good 20 years that people with type 2 diabetes are at hugely increased risk, not just of cardiovascular events, but also of microvascular complications. And of course, that includes nephropathy. So when we think about macrovascular complications, we are not just thinking of heart attack and stroke, we're also thinking of heart failure, for instance, which is the fastest growing complication of type 2 diabetes, according to a report by Diabetes UK. But certainly, diabetic nephropathy is associated with much worse outcomes in type 2 diabetes. For instance, if you have a diagnosis of diabetic nephropathy, you've got an increase of 18% in your 10-year mortality if you've got albuminuria. If your EGFR is below 60, then you've got an increase in mortality over 10 years of 24%. And if you've got both an EGFR below 60 and albuminuria, then you have an increase in mortality of 47% compared to somebody who's got type 2 diabetes, but who has both an EGFR above 60 and no albuminuria. Now, we know that tight glycemic control can improve microvascular outcomes. We have known that for a very, very long time. We know that, you know, the UKPDS, which is still one of the seminal studies on diabetes, showed us that we had this huge reduction or significant reduction in microvascular outcomes. But in recent years, we have started to see the development of medications which can slow the development of macrovascular events, particularly MACE and heart failure. Now, we know that in the long term, you can reduce the risk of macrovascular complications with tight glycemic control, but it is modest compared to the reduction in microvascular events. However, with newer agents, what we are now seeing for the first time, and it literally is the first time since 2015, we've seen drugs which reduce the progression of macrovascular events, MACE and heart failure and cardiovascular death, over and above what we would expect from reduction in HbA1c. So it all started, I think, in 2007, when Steve Nissen published a meta-analysis looking at rosiglitazone, which of course has not been on the market in the UK for many years now, because what it showed was that although rosiglitazone, which of course is a relation of a fellow drug to pioglitazone, although it reduced your HbA1c, unfortunately, there was evidence in this meta-analysis that it increased your risk of cardiovascular events, and there was a trend towards an increase in cardiovascular death as a result. As a result of that, the FDA mandated cardiovascular outcome trials, or CVOTs, for every new drug seeking a license for type 2 diabetes. They didn't have to have the results of those trials by the time it got a license, but they had to have evidence that there was no increase in cardiovascular events. So after that, of course, all the DPP-4s came out, and they were pretty much all neutral. They didn't show any reduction, but they didn't show any increase in cardiovascular events. And that was enough for them to be allowed a license compared to existing trials. But then we had the EMPA-REG outcome trial in 2015. And this was absolutely seminal. These were patients with type 2 diabetes and pre-existing cardiovascular disease. So it was a secondary prevention trial. And they showed that the 3-point MACE was reduced by 14%, that cardiovascular death was reduced by an extraordinary 38%, and that heart failure, hospitalization for heart failure, was reduced by 35%, and all-cause mortality was reduced by 32%. And that wasn't compared to placebo, it was compared to placebo plus standard treatment. And I think that's really, really important, because in terms of the number of patient years of treatment required to prevent one death, what that showed was that it was actually reducing deaths by more than statins were in 4S or ACE inhibitors were in the HOPE trial. In terms of renal problems, we have huge issues. We've got 3.63 million people who have renal problems today in the UK, and by 2030, it's likely to be over 4 million. About half of all people with type 2 diabetes have got chronic kidney disease. And of those, they're not going to die from end-stage renal failure. In fact, only 10% of them die from end-stage renal failure. 60% of them die from cardiovascular causes. So what we're seeing is this really close interconnectivity. These three are inextricably linked in diabetes: cardio, renal, metabolic outcomes. So for instance, if you've got your cardiovascular risk per 100 patient years is 4 if you've got stage 3A CKD, it's 12 if you've got stage 3B, it's 22 if you've got stage 4, and it's 36 if you've got stage 5 CKD. And that is your cardiovascular event risk. Then I've already mentioned heart failure, and even today, survival is overall worse than myocardial infarction. It's worse than survival rates these days for breast cancer, for bowel cancer, and even in some cases for ovarian cancer. So your heart failure risk is about doubled if you've got type 2 diabetes, and if you've got type 1 diabetes, it's increased by 2.5 to 3-fold. That means that if you've got type 2 diabetes and you're 60 years old, then if you don't have cardiovascular disease, compared to somebody who has got type 2 and cardiovascular disease, their life expectancy is reduced by 6 years. And if they've got, if they haven't got those, if they have got type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease, it's reduced by 11.2 years. And if they've got type 2 diabetes and early CKD, then their life expectancy is reduced by 9.1 years compared to somebody without type 2 diabetes.
Gosh, that's that really brings it home, I think. I hadn't really appreciated myself the morbidity and the mortality from type 2 diabetes combined with those other illnesses. And certainly that's really opened my eyes to the significance of those crossover illnesses and how they impact health. And why it's important that we look for all of them rather than just focusing on one at a time, definitely.
Yeah.
And so we've touched on this. Obviously, we've talked about the interconnected nature of these systems. So does that then have an impact on the management of type 2 diabetes?
Absolutely. So it's all very well to say you increase your risk if you've got it. What about if you manage it and you prevent it? And we've known, again, for a long time, there was a very small but really powerful study called Steno 2. And this was long before the days where hypoglycemic agents, glucose lowering agents, had any impact on other risk factors. But what they found was that they, by trying to look at all the risk factors together, they were trying to keep blood pressure under control, cholesterol, triglycerides, and keeping their HbA1c below 48 millimoles per mole. They had intensified treatment, and the study lasted for 7.8 years, but they then had follow-up. And over that 20-year follow-up, they found that if you could intensify treatment in all of those areas, then you could actually increase median lifespan by 7.9 years. This was just extraordinary, because no one of those parameters alone had anything like that impact on your longevity. But again, as I say, I go back to this idea that until 2015, really the only way that we could do that was by addressing each of those individually. So you could reduce blood pressure by using antihypertensives, you could reduce cholesterol by using statins or other parameters. And I hope it goes without saying that whenever I talk about any drug, I'm talking about it in addition to lifestyle. Really, really important. But now we've got numerous studies of several of the SGLT2 inhibitors and the GLP-1 agonists, which show additional benefits in addition to the benefit that we would expect to see from glucose lowering.
Absolutely. I think it's a much more holistic and beneficial approach from just focusing on that HbA1c. And I wonder if actually it'll mean that patients are going to be more aware of taking their medication regularly, because maybe they're not having to have so many different ones for different types of things, and they're going to understand a bit more that actually this will be beneficial for them as a whole. Yeah. As we're discussing the importance of cardiovascular protection, do you think the recent cardiovascular outcome trials have changed our perception and priorities in the management of people with type 2 diabetes?
Well, I really hope they've changed all of our perceptions and all of our priorities. They have certainly changed the international guideline priorities. So, for instance, if we look at, say, the 2021 ADA guidelines, which are the American guidelines, and of course, we will all be aware that effectively, the NICE guidance on type 2 diabetes has not been updated since 2015. There was a very, very minor change at the end of 2021, which related specifically to patients with type 2 diabetes and CKD. And there they made a recommendation to add in an SGLT2 if other treatments had been optimized. But really, other than that, the NICE guidance has not been updated since 2015. And it's very important, therefore, that I think we look to the much more recent evidence-based guidelines, which are based on all of these studies which have come out since then, until NICE produces its new guidance, which we hope it will do in 2022. But if we look at the ADA recommendations, then what their recommendations are is first line is still metformin and obviously comprehensive lifestyle changes. But you then look at every patient for whether they have either indicators of high risk or they have established ASCVD, atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, whether they have chronic kidney disease or whether they have heart failure, either whether they have them or they have indicators of high risk for those. And you consider those independently, really importantly, of the baseline HbA1c. You consider it independently of whether you're using individual HbA1c targets, and we can touch on that, I think, in a minute, because for frail patients, we really do need to be thinking about individualizing treatment. But their recommendation basically is that if they've got either atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease or they're at high risk of it, and a lot of our patients are, you know, they've got raised cholesterol, raised blood pressure, then your options should be for your second line treatment either an SGLT2, which has got proven benefits of cardiovascular risk reduction, or a GLP-1 analog, which has got proven cardiovascular benefit. If they've got heart failure or high risk indicators for heart failure, it should be an SGLT2, which has got proven benefit in this population. And if they've got CKD, if they've got albuminuria as well, then the first line treatment as an add-on to metformin should be an SGLT2 with evidence that it reduces CKD progression. And again, NICE has got its updates on there. or we should be thinking about a GLP-1 if they can't tolerate that. If they're not tolerating the SGLT2 or if they've got a contraindication, then we should be looking at a GLP-1, which has got proven cardiovascular benefit. So this is the first time, really, if you look at NICE, it's effectively give metformin and after that, almost stick a pin in the BNF. Whereas here, they are very much more looking at individual risk factors and targeting those.
Brilliant. And I'm hoping, having had a look at the ADA guidelines, it seems much clearer from a primary care point of view exactly what you should be doing rather than, as you said before, kind of taking your pick on what you do after metformin. So we've mentioned some of those new medications, so the SGLT2 inhibitors and the GLP-1 RAs. Are they relevant to specific groups of people?
Yeah, I think the answer is that most of our patients are going to be at high risk of one or more of those conditions. And it's interesting that we're now in the position where they're not just saying if you've got established cardiovascular disease, because that's what they were saying. In 2019, we had the ADA EASD consensus report. And interestingly, that was actually led by a UK diabetologist. So that's, I think, you know, we may not officially be in Europe anymore, but certainly that was an updated guideline where they recommended that for patients with established cardiovascular disease or heart failure, we should be thinking about these drugs. Now we're looking at people who are at high risk of these conditions. So I think we need to be much more careful about regularly measuring UACR, urine albumin creatinine ratio. Unfortunately, it's not in QOF, I think, any longer. And therefore, you know, there is certainly during the pandemic, it's been quite difficult. But, you know, we need to remember, for instance, patients got an EGFR over 60 could still have stage one or stage two CKD if they have got raised urine albumin creatinine ratio. So, you know, those patients are definitely at high risk. They may be below the threshold for diagnosis, but they could, and they may have an EGFR over 60, but they are still at high risk. Now, one group we shouldn't forget are frail patients. So QOF has made the point that if you've got a patient who's been assessed as being older or frail, then you, if the last HbA1c was less than or equal to 75 millimoles per mole, then they should be assessed for frailty. And if you look at David Strain's paper, which is a fantastic consensus paper about what we do with frailty, then he very much says we should be looking at targeted HbA1c. So if you've got a patient who is pre-frail, or who has mild frailty, then yes, by all means, go for an HbA1c of 58 millimoles per mole or less. If they've got moderate frailty and it can't be reversed, then think about closer to 64 millimoles per mole as a lower target. And if it's severe frailty, then you probably shouldn't be looking below 69 millimoles per mole. But, and here's the big but, what they also say, again, and I go back to those ADA guidance, is that this should be considered, their other risk factors should be considered independent of their baseline HbA1c. So we've got specific groups where we've got definite proof. So for instance, for patients with type 2 diabetes, secondary prevention, the SGLT2, which the only one which has provided specific mortality benefits is empagliflozin in EMPA-REG. For patients, for instance, who've got heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, both dapagliflozin and empagliflozin both now have evidence and licenses for type 2 diabetes for people with HEF-REF, so heart failure with reduced ejection fracture. Interestingly, empagliflozin and dapagliflozin have also now got licenses for heart failure with reduced ejection fraction for patients without type 2 diabetes. If you've got chronic kidney disease and you've got type 2 diabetes as well, then canagliflozin and dapagliflozin have both got licenses, and dapagliflozin has got a license for patients with CKD who don't have type 2 diabetes at all. So if you think about all of those groups, this is a significant, really significant group. At the moment, there is no drug which has got a license in the UK for of these SGLT2s or the GLP-1s for heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. And that's a really, really tough one, I'm sure you'll agree, to treat, because the options we've got are so limited. Now, interestingly, we have now got the results of the EMPEROR Preserved, which show that there is a significant reduction in those outcomes in patients with preserved ejection fraction with empagliflozin. But as yet, we don't have a license. But I suspect, given that it's been given a license in the USA, the FDA has approved it, I suspect it's a question of watch this space.
Wow, that's really interesting, actually, because like you said, the HFpEF management is very limited at the moment. So that would be a really big bonus if that's possible. And what about those people who don't have any of those risk factors? So they've got type 2 diabetes, but actually they don't have hypertension or heart failure, or they don't have the risk factors for it.
That's a really, really difficult one. In the majority of cases, quite frankly, patients, if they don't have them already, they're going to get them. The only exception perhaps might be, you know, we do get little old ladies or little old gentlemen as well. But, you know, people whose pancreas, I suppose, runs out of juice effectively. They don't have, you know, abdominal obesity. They don't have any obvious risk factors, but they have got, they develop type 2 diabetes. Now, of course, usually they're older patients and they are going to be at high risk for cardiovascular disease anyway. Now, we do just need to be aware that particularly with the SGLT2s, I'm sure everybody is aware of this risk of diabetic ketoacidosis. And we do just need to think, if you've got a patient where you look at them and you think, you've got a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes and I don't understand why. And there are, you know, we all get them occasionally. And of course, those patients may have LADA, latent autoimmune diabetes of adulthood. And in those patients, they may well be very insulin deficient. And those sort of patients may be at higher risk of diabetic ketoacidosis. So I think on the whole, my feeling is these drugs have got the SGLT2s and the GLP-1s, although currently, of course, the GLP-1s are very limited in who they can be prescribed for. They're limited in terms of body mass index because of NICE. But certainly with the GLP-1s, to me, these seem the ultimate primary care drugs. You know, the diabetologist tried to claim them first, the cardiologist tried to get their hands on them next, and now even the renal physicians have got in on the act and they're trying to claim them as their drugs. I see them as primary care drugs because, of course, they do exactly what sulfonylureas do or DPP-4s do in terms of lowering HbA1c. But they have all these additional benefits as well. Although they're not licensed for it, they do reduce blood pressure, they do reduce weight. And of course, you've got this evidence of protection against future CKD and cardiovascular disease and heart failure. And we know that our patients with type 2 diabetes are at high risk of those.
And that's the SGLT2 inhibitors, is that right?
Yeah, that's the SGLT2 inhibitors.
Brilliant. And we've talked a bit about the safety aspects. We've talked about frailty and the importance of personalized targets and the slightly increased risk of DKA with SGLT2 inhibitors. Are there any other safety aspects that we need to be aware of?
Yeah, I think that, you know, in these times of COVID, I'm amazed we've got as long into this discussion as we have without mentioning COVID. But whether you've got somebody who is poorly from COVID or anything else, we do need to think about SAD man. So we do just need to bear in mind that it's not just patients with LADA who might be a higher risk of DKA. The risk of DKA, diabetic ketoacidosis, is very, very small, particularly if you pick your patients. You're not looking at patients who might have LADA. You're not looking at patients who are on a very severely carbohydrate restricted diet. You know, the keto diet, for instance, or these very, very low carb diets, they do increase the risk of DKA. But if you've got a patient who is at risk of dehydration, a risk of volume depletion, then they are going to be at risk not just from DKA if they're taking SGLT2, but from all sorts of other issues. So that following the SAD man's rules is really important. We should be considering pausing. Very important. If you stop, you might not restart. Pausing sulfonylureas, ACE inhibitors, diuretics, metformin, ARBs, and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. So all of those we do need to think about, but it's really, really important, I think, that we think about pausing rather than stopping, because the big concern is, you know, how many times have we had patients who've come out of hospital, they've been taken off all their drugs because, you know, they were severely unwell, or because, you know, their EGFR dropped through the floor, they had acute on chronic renal kidney problems, and they come out and the next thing we know they've been off those drugs for a long time. And I think now that we've got these added bonus benefit drugs, I think we really do need to be thinking seriously about them.
That's really useful. And I do like the term pausing. I think that's a really important term, isn't it? And thinking about the sick day rules and sad man, and making sure patients are aware that actually they do need to restart those medications once they're feeling better. Yeah. So unfortunately, type 2 diabetes is becoming increasingly common. And I know sometimes that I struggle with engaging patients in their diabetes management. Sometimes it's almost becoming so common that everyone has it, so actually it's not that bad kind of thinking sometimes, and trying to help patients understand the importance of taking their medication regularly. Do you have any tips that might help?
I mean, it's so important. It really, really is. You know, again, unlike you, I trained back in the day when consultations, you know, when the idea of a collaborative consultation was very much in its infancy. And certainly the consultation models that I was taught when I was a GP trainee were very different from the ones we get now. And what we now know is that basically scare tactics don't work. It's as simple as that. We have to look at shared decision making. Now, shared decision making is something which people may not be quite as familiar with as they are with motivational interviewing. Motivational interviewing is all about finding what the patient's priorities are and getting their ideas on board. But that tends to be to do with the difference between making good choices and what the doctor would consider to be bad choices. Shared decision making is different. Shared decision making is where you've got several options, any of which could be considered appropriate. And here we're thinking particularly about drug option treatments. But it's where the patient, the clinician, and the patient together make decisions, and they're using the best available evidence. But the patients are encouraged to look at the benefits and harms of each. They're considered to think about in an informed way. And of course, this is the really important point, is to think about the benefits and harms and what the management options might be that best work for them. So there, the clinician's role is very much about helping the patient to become well-informed, about helping them develop their personal preferences for available options, and obviously providing professional guidance where that is appropriate. We know it reduces healthcare costs. We know it improves adherence. We know it improves self-management. And importantly, we know it improves satisfaction, which is really, really important. So it's got to be about the patient being in a position where they understand and really do understand the risks and the benefits for them. It can take a little bit more time, but you know, we're thinking more about putting them in the position of being an informed consumer, I suppose. But motivational interviewing is more about addressing ambivalence to behavior change that is good for, that is medically indicated, that we know is good for the patient. Shared decision making, by contrast, is more about supporting patients and giving them the tools they need to make healthcare decisions that are best for them.
That's brilliant. That's really clear, actually, and very helpful to have that difference between shared decision making and motivational interviewing made crystal clear. Thank you so much for your time today. It's unfortunately that's all the time that we've got. It's been incredibly interesting and really relevant to primary care. And I just thank you again for taking the time to speak to us.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity and for stimulating me so much.
Thank you. And thank you everyone for listening to the RCGP podcast on type 2 diabetes.